You are listening to KDUX Web Radio, broadcasting live from Richland College in Dallas, Texas. We're the voice of Richland College. My name is Raymond Thomas Pronk, the presenter of the Pronk Pop Show. Views expressed on this show are my own, unless otherwise stated, and do not reflect the opinions of anyone at KDUX, Richland College, or the DCC. The Richland Chronicle, which I've written some articles that actually would be appearing not this issue, but probably the next two issues after that, actually have to do exactly with the topic that I'm going to be talking about. Now, I hadn't when I was driving in, and this is what happens, I was listening to the news. Actually, I think it was not the news. It was Rush Limbaugh was playing a clip. I got to think about that. I'm not sure. It might have been the news. Anyways, it was about the top of the hour. And what they were, it was a quote that President Obama said, the error of austerity has ended. Now, I scratched my head on that one. I said, huh? It sort of relates to the story I was doing yesterday, which I do have an update on the FCC wanting to put in monitors in newsrooms. That hasn't been going over very well, but I'll get back to that in a minute. So what I'm going to be talking about is that quote, the era of austerity is ended. Anyone, a president of the United States saying that today, the only conclusion is he's either completely unaware of the facts, which I don't think he is, or he's delusional. Because we haven't had an era of austerity. In other words, what is he talking about? And what I mean by that, for the first 4 years of his administration, the government spent over $1 trillion more than they collected in taxes year after year after year after year. That is not austerity. That's fiscally, I call it fiscal insanity. That's nuts. Because you can't continue doing this. And apparently he thinks he can, because if you believe what the president says, now I don't, but if you believe what the president says, you might get the impression that we're going to go on a spending binge. No, we're not, because for the simple reason the House is controlled by the Republicans, and given the reception of Obamacare, it's a very high probability, I'd say 60-40, that the Senate will also being controlled by the Republicans after the November elections. Now, I'm not a Republican or Democrat, and frankly, I'm just as critical of the Republicans when they were in power for their spending habits. I call it, they both political parties have what I call spending addiction disorder. Spending addiction disorder. And what I mean by that, they run these massive deficits that the American people simply can't pay for it. The best way to say this, is that we have a government that the American people literally cannot afford to pay for. Because what's happening is every year, you know, through George Bush's administration as well as Barack Obama's administration, every year we run deficits of hundreds of billions of dollars. And when President Obama took office, first fiscal year was 2009. Now, admittedly, fiscal year 2009, the fiscal years run from 1 October to 30 September, and the fiscal year for 2009 started 1 October 2008. So President Bush was still president for October, November, December, and most of January. So part of the responsibility is definitely goes to George Bush, but I need to be very careful here, and I always remind people you have to look at who controls both the House and Senate. As a direct result of the 206 elections, the Democratic Party took power of both the House and the Senate. In other words, they control both houses of Congress starting in 2007, and that's important because the huge deficits started in fiscal year 2008, 9, 10, 11, and 12. And for most of that time, the Democrats had control of both houses, and starting in 2009 with Obama, the presidency. That's where we've had these massive deficits. We have not had austerity. Austerity is defined where the government is trying to cut the deficits by dramatically cutting spending and or increasing taxes. Now, I will say this, President Obama is increasing taxes, even though he promised if you're earning less than $250,000, your taxes will not go up by a single penny or a dime. That was another one of his big lies or big whoppers. Because Obamacare is a tax. The Supreme Court said it was. It wasn't sold as a tax. They denied it was a tax. But the Supreme Court said Obamacare, or the Affordable Care Act, or the long name for it, the Patient Protection and Affordable Care Act, was a tax. And it is, because it's mandated that individuals buy health insurance. Now, the Supreme Court ruled that the U.S. government could not mandate that, but they could mandate a penalty if you didn't buy it. So here's the problem. If you're an individual, you're not on Medicare, you're not poor, you're not on Medicaid, you're compelled by law to buy it or face a penalty. Now, you don't have to buy it, but if you don't, then the IRS can come after you for the penalty. Most people, especially young people, and this bill was directed at young people, are not signing up in the numbers that the administration expected or the Democratic Party expected. And the term they're using is to describe young people as the invincibles. But they're saying that in a rather pejorative way. Yes, there are some young people that think they're never going to die. They're not going to need medical care. Now, as a general proposition, when you're young, your needs for medical care are relatively minor. That's been my experience as well as most young people. Now, occasionally you might sprain your ankle, break your leg, cut yourself, and require some medical assistance. But most people's, their largest medical bills are in their last year of their life, and the only problem is they don't know when that is. But for most people in the United States, that's in their 70s and 80s, and some cases 90s, and that's where they're going to really need health insurance to make sure that they have the money to pay for medical care, and that's why we have in existence today, Medicare, that was passed in 1965. And the problem there is both Medicare and Medicaid, which is for the poor, both of those programs are running massive deficits. In other words, what the American people were promised or overpromised is facing unfunded liabilities. In other words, the federal government simply does not have the money to pay the bills. And that's partially why we're running these massive deficits, because every day upwards of 10,000 people or more are now qualifying for Medicare, because we have a huge baby boom generation of over 75 million people. And as they grow older and qualify for Medicare, which they do at age 65, once they have their 65th birthday, usually a month or two ahead of time, they can apply for Medicare and they get a Medicare card and can use that to pay for some of their medical services that they need. Now, I always tell people, Medicare is not enough. Really doesn't pay enough. And what most people, if they can afford it, will buy is a Medicare supplement policy. And that's not cheap either. That's several thousand dollars a month, typically for an individual. So if you combine if you have both, then most, if not all, of your health care needs will be provided. You're still going to have deductibles and you're still going to have co-payments, but your big catastrophic bills will be taken care of by both Medicare and your supplement. But you need both. Other people have elected to take Medicare Advantage, and that's just another way to make sure you have the money to pay the bills should you have need of health care, either doctor, surgery, whatever, if you have it. And you will have it as you grow older, because, like I said, the statistics are the actuaries for the insurance companies that figure what the premium should be are well aware of the incidence of people having illness or a medical condition, and that definitely rises with age. And that's why medical insurance for older people is quite expensive. It goes up. But conversely, for younger people, for example, most of the students on campus, with the possible exception of a serious automobile accident, are not going to need any major health care services. And they know that, because they have experience with it and so do their friends. And yes, maybe one in 100 or so has major bills, and that's why it's not a bad idea to have catastrophic care. I'm not urging you not to buy health insurance. I think you should buy it if you can afford it. But if you're unemployed, which many of them are, and can't find jobs, then they're not going to buy it. And what was amazing to me is the president's wife was making a statement and talking about young people and described them as knuckleheads, but was making the point, which is not really diplomatic, if you will. I don't think you call one of your major or important. Obama got a lot of the youth vote, I guess what I'm trying to say. Now, I need to quickly point out, and most people are aware of that, young people typically don't vote. I'm not for that, but that's just a fact. When you're young, politics simply is not of interest. But if someone were to call me a knucklehead, guess what? I wouldn't vote for them. Well, they don't need to be diplomatic anymore. They don't need to hide their views. And I think it was a poor choice or selection of words, because what's happening is, to the extent that young people are aware of what's going on and that they need to buy health insurance, they're not happy, because the health insurance they need to buy is expensive. Even with subsidies, it's expensive. And the president's wife was trying to say, well, you could buy it for $50 a month. Yeah, there are plans out there that you can buy for $50 a month, but the deductibles will be $10,000 or higher. You see, the dirty little secret is, not only was Obamacare aimed at forcing young people to buy health insurance, because there were a large percentage of the people that didn't get insured. Mainly, you're dealing with people from 18 to their early 30s. 18 to 34 is the group that typically was not insured. Now, what usually happened is, when an individual got married and if they were planning to have children, then suddenly they get very, very interested in health insurance. Up until that time, when they're really single and on their own, yeah, they'll sign up for health insurance if the employer pays for it. They're not irrational, but they're not a big buyer of health insurance on their own, if the employer does not provide it, they don't go out and search it. By making it mandatory, that to some extent would force them, because if they don't buy it, they face a penalty, but the penalty is a lot less than what the cost of the insurance is. You see, if you want there are different plans you can buy, these so-called metal plans, the bronze, the silver, and the gold. The problem is, the better the plan, the more money it's going to cost. And even though you're younger and your premiums will be lower, the real shock, sticker shock, is first the premiums, especially if you've had coverage. The premiums alone are typically 50% to 100% more if you're buying an individual plan. But the big shock is the deductibles, and it varies amongst which plans you buy. But for example, for the bronze plan, many of the deductibles were $3,500. The problem is, if you're having trouble paying the premium, you don't have the money to pay the deductible. And the deductible is typically anywhere from 3 to 5 times higher than if they had a current plan. So you're really getting sticker shock, and it's not just the young. It gets worse as you get older. But it is the young that are really revolting on Obamacare. They're not going to participate in anywhere near what the government thought they would, and that is critical, because if they can't get the young's participation rate up, this Obamacare will fail, because it's relying on young people subsidizing older and sick people. And the reason they do that is, although the First Lady is mocking the knuckleheads, well, the smart knuckleheads aren't buying it because they don't want to subsidize older and sicker people. And many of the so-called knuckleheads, according to First Lady Obama, should be able to afford $50. Well, many of them can, but many of them can't find jobs. And see, that's the big problem. The real problem today, it's really twofold, and I want to relate it to together, is the fact that we have such high unemployment rates. And together, you got to look at not only at the unemployment rate, but the labor participation rate is at a rate that we had when Jimmy Carter was president, where most of the young people were not even born. That was 1978. That's 36 years ago. Most of these young people, well, all of the young people weren't born. And the reason why that's important is if we had today the labor participation rate is 63%. That's what it was last month. It should be somewhere between 66 and 67%, or a little bit higher than that. If it were in that range, the unemployment rate would not be 6.6%. It would be over 10%, and probably over 11% if you use the higher participation rate. See, that's the dirty little secret. Now, how does that affect you and me? Well, for young people, college, people going to college or working at their first job, if they have one, they're not able to find jobs. And if they can find a job, it's usually part-time. And they're entry-level jobs. They're not good-paying jobs, and they're entry-level. And what's happening is they're having to compete with millions of people. And I've run into that over and over again. People are applying for a job where at one time you might have gotten, 5 to 10 applicants. Today you're getting dozens of applicants, in some cases hundreds of applicants. So your chances of even getting an interview are slim and none. And even if you get an interview, you're still competing and you might not get the job. As a result, teenage unemployment rates are sky high. They're at 20% or over. And amongst black teenagers, it's between 30 and 40%. It's going to fluctuate month to month. The message I'm trying to get across is this. One of the key reasons you're not going to have high participation in Obamacare by young people, 18 to 32, 34, is the simple fact that they don't have the money. They're unemployed. What's going to happen? Most of those people, if they do need medical care, are going to apply for Medicaid. And that's Medicaid. To get Medicaid, you in essence have to be poor. You're indigent. And because of that situation, you can get a welfare program. It's a welfare program, and that needs to be said. You're not buying anything. The problem you get into there is finding a doctor that will treat you. It's not like there are no doctors that won't take Medicaid patients. There are, but the best doctors simply don't, because they don't need to. And especially specialists, they don't need to. And they don't want to because the government doesn't reimburse at the usual and customary charges. And that's the same for Medicare. The United States government, because of its monopoly position, does not reimburse doctors at a sufficient rate. That's why most people that have the money, that are 65 and older, that qualify for Medicare, also have supplemental insurance, so-called Medicare supplement. And they do that to pay what the government doesn't pay. Well, it's actually much worse for Medicaid. So as a direct result of that, the good doctors, as well as the specialists, don't take Medicaid patients. So if you find yourself in the unlucky situation of truly needing Medicare or services of either a doctor or a surgeon or a therapist, whatever your medical condition is, good luck first even finding someone that will provide you the care. And it's going to be tremendously difficult if you truly have a condition that really only a specialist can treat, because there are fewer and far between. So why it might give you some comfort if you're unemployed, not earning enough money to qualify for Medicaid, it's not really a solution. The solution is really a good job where you have coverage. Now, why have we had this persistently high unemployment rate? Over 6%. It's been over 6.5% for the last 63 months. And it's been over 8% for 43 of those 63 months, more than two-thirds of the time. And those numbers are very, very misleading, because in conjunction with those high unemployment rates, we've had a significant drop in the labor participation rate, which means people are giving up looking for work. Now, they'll come back. If the economy were booming, all of those people that are now discouraged will come back and will find jobs. You see, the ideal situation, you want a falling unemployment rate and a rising participation rate. And by rising, I mean in the 66 or 67% range. We're nowhere close to that, because if we were, we would have unemployment rates of under 5%, typically between 3 and 5%, somewhere in that range. Now, you'll get a debate amongst economists what exactly is near. You're never going to have full employment in the sense that everyone that wants to work is working. You're always going to have some frictional unemployment because people are between jobs or looking for a job. But as far as I'm concerned, if the unemployment rate were less than 3%, then we're at full employment. And guess what? We've had times in U.S. history when it's been below 3%, actually below 2%. Now, you have to go back to the 1928 to find those numbers. What's happening is, and what is the core problem today in the United States? Earlier this week, I went over a recent Gallup poll that came out a couple of weeks ago that listed the five top, well, actually, there are 10 top problems that the American people see. Now, what is the number one problem that the American people, when they're surveyed, indicate? What would you think it is? It's jobs. And right behind it is the economy. And they're absolutely right. Now, they don't know these numbers, but they know either they're unemployed or their children are unemployed or their friends, relatives. Not everyone's hurting. There are people that have jobs. The majority of Americans have jobs. Thank God. But this is literally the worst period of unemployment since the Great Depression. You have to go back into the 1930s, the 1930s period, to find a worse period in terms of the unemployment rates. And what I mean by that, and it was worse, the unemployment rates were over 14%. They actually got as high as 24.9%, not quite 25%, but 24.9% in March of 1933. Now, that translated into roughly 13 million people. Now, today, the government's official number, the U3 rate, is 6.6%. But that's the headline number. Now, I don't have off the top of my head what the U6 number. I believe it's 12%. It's about not quite twice that. And I have to double check that. But that's the more comparable number to that 24.9%. You see, what the government has done over time, especially in the Clinton administration, is redefine what unemployment is to get the number down so it doesn't look too as bad as it truly is. But it is bad. Now, let's relate it back to the core story. What I think the core problem in the United States is out-of-control spending. And that was, I believe, the fourth or fifth problem. The way to describe that is deficits. The concern for the deficits, federal government deficits, as well as the national debt. It's a top problem or concern of the American people. Both of them are related, and that's why I made a point. Most of these problems are all related, interconnected. You can't just talk about one without connecting it to the other. But it's really frustrating when the president says the end of austerity is now. It isn't. It's not ended. It hasn't even begun. That's truly misleading. That, frankly, it's a lie. Because if we're over $500 billion away from balancing the budget. You see, when you're cutting deficits, the objective is to have a balanced budget where you don't have a deficit. The beginning of the end of austerity is when your budgets are balanced, and we're nowhere near that. And what's really scary is, while we have a couple of years where the deficits sort of flatten off, they flatten off above $500 billion, which is half a trillion. And I know some people have trouble with the numbers. $1 billion equals $1,000 million. The deficit, we're in fiscal year 2014. That began 1 October of 2013 and ends September 30th of 2014. It's estimated that that deficit will be over $500 billion. I'm waiting to see. The prior fiscal year that ended, fiscal year 2013, that ended September 30th of last year, 2013, the deficit was $680 billion. You see the problem? We're nowhere near balancing the budget. And you don't end austerity until you at least get to a balanced budget, and we're not near it. And what's scary is, yes, the deficits tend to flatten out, but then if you look beyond the next 2 to 3 years, they start going, heading right back up to over $1 trillion. We haven't had austerity. That's the point. We haven't had dramatic cuts in spending. And that's exactly what has to happen and will happen, because if you ignore it, what happens is the debts get bigger and bigger, and then the what I call and other people call the debt bomb explodes. Because as the debt gets bigger and bigger, what happens? Interest gets bigger and bigger. Now, for those that are first-time listeners, and I should have said this at the top of the program, especially for this show, the way you listen to my show, or the way most people listen to my show, is go to pronkpops.wordpress.com. That's pronkpops, P-R-O-N-K, .wordpress.com. And that'll take you to the Pronk Pops blog. And right at the top, you'll see a nice picture of me that I put together. But under it, you'll have links of all the recent shows from November through today. And below that, you have grouped a complete archive, or what I call the Pronk Pop Show podcast portfolio of all my shows. Many of the earlier shows were weekly one-hour shows. Now I've gone to a daily show. But you link on them, and that's how you listen to the show. And that will take you to a podcast that you can either download or listen to via streaming. So that's how you listen to the show. But the point I was trying to make is this. Underneath that, you have a lot of information, especially for this story, because I really can't do justice to the details of the budget. And I know a lot of you, this could be very, very dry, but it does affect your life. It really does affect your life, because people are going to college at Richland College to first get their 2 years completed at a fairly reasonable price, even though the tuition is more than doubled. I've been taking courses on and off at Richland College since 1998. Now, many of those years, I didn't take anything, but initially I was interested in programming, so I took some programming computer courses and eventually got an associate degree in that. And following that, I got one in web design and development. But after that, I worked in what I worked. I didn't go to school. So it's on and off. But I can remember that when the tuition was a lot lower. A 3-credit course would cost either $60 or $75. Today, it's over $155. So in the course of about 15 years, the price of education in terms of the tuition at Richland is more than doubled. And you got to keep in mind, these community colleges get subsidies from the state as well. So education has been impacted and has experienced inflation. Now, what's happened is it's somewhat of a racket. As the government provides more loans, more subsidies, if you will, to students, what happens? Across the country, every college jacks up the tuition rates. But that's just the start of it. If you go to any college campus today, you will be amazed at the prices you have to pay for books. And I think it's a racket. I really do. And that's why the value of a college education is increasingly being challenged. Because if you speak to students, and I have, And I've noticed it too. I've had some very good professors. I need to say that. Many of them were adjunct professors, part-time professors. But what I've seen happening is the dumbing down of a college education. You see, this is a business, and part of the business is to get people, I call it butts in the seats. They're trying to get butts in the seats. They have a lot of classrooms. They've built up the infrastructure. They have buildings, classrooms with chairs in them, and the goal is to put people in those chairs. And they don't, even though many of them, and I would say 25% to a third, shouldn't be here. They really don't have the capabilities to succeed. And many of them, most of them drop out. I remember it was, probably 2 years ago, I got invited to listen to a chancellor that was speaking really to the faculty and staff. And I was thinking of writing an article on it. That's why I went. Now, I don't remember much about that speech, but one thing sticks in my mind. And I might be a little off in the number, but not much. And I don't think I am. The chancellor, and this is for the entire Dallas County Community College District, he has since retired, by the way, made a point and said this is really a challenge for us. If you take people that enroll at the DCCD colleges, whether it's Richland colleges or the other colleges in the district, the rate, the percentage that actually completes either that degree or certification, because a lot of people already have degrees, so they go to their programs that they have that will certify you in a specialty, if you will. And I have a few of those too, certifications. The percentage, and I would, if you asked me to guess, I would have said 40%. No, it wasn't 40%. They would love it to be 40%. It was 21%. Whoa. 21%. In other words, almost 4 out of 5, not quite, but almost 4 out of 5 individuals that enroll at the various colleges in the DCCD district are not completing their degrees. Now, that's not unique. I'm not trying to pick on the Dallas area. That's across the country. That's another dirty secret that they don't like to advertise. You see, there's a lot of competitions to get students to go to college and come to a specific university. Every year, like clockwork, we had it this week on campus, colleges come and try to recruit students that are going to Richland College to go after they've completed their associate degree to go to their college. And there's usually at least 24. They need people to fill the classrooms. Just like Richland College needs people to come, these universities, the so-called senior universities, and in Dallas, that could be the University of Texas at Dallas. It could be Southern Methodist University. It could be the University of Texas at Arlington. It could be Texas Christian University or Texas A&M. Commerce is another. There are many, many colleges in Texas, but also outside of Texas. And the University of Texas at Austin, for example, or the University of Texas A&M. So there's a lot of competition to get students from community colleges to continue their education at a four-year university. Now, what happens is, even though the community colleges, attendance is actually down, by the way, which doesn't surprise me, because what happens when parents are unemployed? Their children... Children, if they can't find a job, guess what? They're not going to be going to school until their parents find a job or they find a job, even though the tuition is much lower. But the textbooks are much higher. I mean, significantly. If you went to school like I did many, many years ago, I look at the prices of the books, and I literally refuse to pay for them. And see, and I have my degrees. I have my bachelor's, I have 3 master's, I don't need any degrees. The only reason I take any courses here is the fact that I'm trying to get into commercial radio and to have access to the studio and to broadcast the show. I have to at least be an enrolled in student at Richland College. So I play the game. So I take one course, and that's subsidized too. Won't get into that, but it is. But still, I have to pay for the books. I'm enrolled in, I have two courses that I have to take before I get another associate's in mass communications. In other words, I'll finish this program for what I hope to be my future successful career, but I wanted to get the experience, and really the experience is what I'm doing right now, communicating, being able to produce a show. Now, I'm going through this because I want to relate what's happening on college campuses and what's the real problem that America is facing and the American people are facing. So what happened to most of these students, they're accumulating more and more debt, and they're having increasing difficulty. It's not impossible. There are students that find jobs on campus. Many of them are international students that can only work on campus, as well as off campus. I'm not trying to paint it's entirely negative. It isn't. The problem is you're increasing your debt load to pay for your education, to pay for your books. And that's just the first 2 years that are relatively inexpensive if you go to a community college. Then you have an additional 2 years at a senior institution where the tuition is much higher, much higher. Even if you're in-state, it's much higher. And the books are just as expensive there. So what happens is many students, when they finally graduate, have a significant debt burden, a loan. And they're expecting to find a good-paying job to be able to pay that loan over the next 5, 10, or even 15 years. And they're going to have to pay interest on it. It's not free. But the problem is they can't find jobs. Or if they can, it's part-time at a much lower wage rate for the simple reason of we have tens of millions of people unemployed, so they're competing. The competition is significant. And to compound that, we have a federal government that simply refuses to vigorously enforce immigration laws. So not only are they competing with all the unemployed people, many of them that have years of experience as well as their education, they are competing also with illegal aliens, or what the Democrat, I like to call them undocumented Democrats. There are people that have broke into our country and are working here illegally. And usually they commit a crime by breaking into our country. They commit another crime when they get fraudulent documents so they can present to the employer so the employer can hire them. And then when they work, they commit another crime. Now, how does that affect you and me? That means you have more people competing in the labor market. Now, for many of these college graduates, their competition is not illegal immigrants. I need to make that clear. Their competition is the millions, tens of millions of people that have the experience. That's what they're up against, and have work experience skills that employers want versus a college or high school dropout or graduate that has limited skills, and very little work experience. What that means is most college graduates today are not finding good-paying jobs, if they're finding a job at all. Now, how does this relate to the president's statement that the era of austerity has ended? The central problem, as far as I'm concerned, in my humble opinion, is the fact that federal government spending, is simply out of control. It is way beyond the means of the American people to support just with their tax dollars. Every dollar today that the federal government is spending, every single dollar, approximately 35 cents out of that dollar, has to be financed. In other words, the government has to issue securities. It's like you, let's step back from a minute. Let's say you're lucky and have a job. And let's say you have a nice job. It's paying $50,000. And I have a chart on this. If you go to prompt pops.wordpress.com, you'll see this chart. And I want to relate it to you, and I'll jump back. The median family income in the United States, and this information is a little old, but it's not far off. is approximately $51,000. In other words, more than half the people are making more and half the people are making less. But the median family income is $51,000. And that's a little over $4,000 a month. Now, what if you had spent, and this is what people are spending too, just for to give the example, the equivalent. I'm trying to put it in personal terms what the government is doing. It's like you spending $60,500 a month. In other words, you're spending over $10,000. More precisely, I got the number wrong. It's $9,500. The median income is $51,000. You're spending $60,500. So what do? You're spending, you're putting it on a credit card. So every year, you're putting $9,500 on a credit card. Now, that's crazy, but guess what? A lot of Americans do that. But this is the individual's equivalent to what the government is doing. But what's the real problem? And that is a problem in and of itself. And the individual really can't do what the government's doing. Because what'll quickly happen is the banks will not extend, they won't increase your credit line, and you will not get accepted for other credit cards. In other words, you might be able to do this for a year or two, but then it's going to stop real quick. Because what's going to happen is you literally cannot even pay the minimum payments, so you're not going to get any more credit. And your credit will be ruined as you increase the debt. But here is the catch, and here is the critical point. And this is just to give a sense of the reality of what the government is doing, to bring it home. It's like you're doing this, but you already have $300,000 in debt. $300,000 in debt, and you're doing this. Now, an individual can't do it, but the government, that's exactly what they're doing, because they're spending, at every dollar they're spending, 35 cents. And it has been higher than 35 cents. A couple of years ago, it was 40 cents. We've made some improvement. But because every year we have a deficit where spending outlays exceed total tax revenue, that's called a deficit. And the way you have a deficit, in other words, you're spending more money than your income, and where the income from the government is tax revenue, that is a deficit. You have to borrow. And that takes the form of the U.S. Treasury issuing either bills, notes, or bonds, mostly notes and bonds. And when you add up all that debt over time, that's called the national debt. And it's gone up, up, and up. The last time I checked, it was roughly at 17. The gross debt was roughly at $17.4 trillion. And by next March, which that was in the news, they've come to agreement. The Republicans and the Democrats have again agreed to increase the debt ceiling, so we don't have to talk about it until next March, when I'm still, the details of really, I haven't gotten some precise numbers yet, but it'll be around $18 trillion, probably more. You see, if we were truly in an era of austerity, what should be happening? It's not a trick question. We should be dramatically cutting spending, both mandatory spending and discretionary spending. Mandatory spending is for both entitlement programs and, to some extent, welfare programs. But what are the big entitlement programs? By far, and I have a lot of information. I'm scrolling, because I can't keep all these numbers in my head. But I want to put everything in perspective and why eventually we are going to have austerity. The era of austerity, ladies and gentlemen, simply has not begun. That's why when I heard that, I did a double take. Because anyone that says that is delusional or doesn't know the situation. Now, I don't think he's delusional, and I know he knows the situation. He's just playing to his Democratic base. Because let me put it in context and why ultimately something has to give. And what has to give is we're going to have to be forced to make the cuts. Today, the number one entitlement program is Social Security. And that accounts for roughly 22% of the total federal government's budget every year. And it's going to be going up, by the way. But today, it's roughly around 22%, but it's heading up. The next big category of spending, And the one that's really out of hand or out of control is Medicare, Medicaid, and other health care spending. That is about 23%. So if you add the two together, the major entitlement programs that, and what I mean by that is people have paid into this by payroll taxes. Now, Medicaid is a welfare program. That's a little different. But I wanted to include that because for the poor people, they are more and more assuming it is an entitlement, even though it's a welfare program. Together, that the major entitlements are 45% of the federal budget, 45%. So what the government is doing is taking tax dollars that you pay in and turning around and sending it either to you if you're on Social Security or to your doctor or hospital if you need Medicare. You don't get paid. The doctor or the health care provider does. But together, that's 45%. Now, to keep it simple, right now, net interest, another interest on the national debt that you have to pay. In other words, if you're financing these deficits by more and more debt, or think of it as using your more and more credit cards, you need to pay the interest. Well, that today is 6%. In 20 or 30 years, it'll be 3 to 4 times that. But that 6% added to 45 gives you 51%. We haven't talked about defense yet, nor have we talked about all the other departments. But we've already spent half the money that the federal government collects, more than half. Now let's add welfare, food stamps, income security programs, EITC, the Earned Income Tax Credit, Section 8 or subsidized housing, you know, SNAP or food stamps I've mentioned. All of that combined is roughly 19%. You see the problem, ladies and gentlemen? You add that 19% to 51%, you're already at 70% of the budget. And what were they? Entitlement programs, interest, and welfare programs. Entitlement programs, welfare programs, and interest. We're at 70%. That's what our current taxes can pay for. There's a little extra because 35% has to be borrowed. So what are we borrowing the money for? Well, they don't segregate it out this way. But another 19% goes to national defense. That brings us to 89%. The rest is for all the other departments, so-called discretionary spending. National defense spending and the money that goes to other departments is what's called discretionary. Mandatory goes for entitlements, such as Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid. Now, do you see the problem? What's going to happen? Over time, as the size of the federal government gets bigger, as budgets get bigger, the tax revenues pay for less, less, and less, to at some point in time, your tax revenues will only pay for entitlements and the national debt. And there's a chart showing that and showing the crossover point, and it's at 2030. By 2030, it's estimated that entitlements plus interest will consume all our tax revenues. Let me say that again. By 2030, and that's 16 years away, because if you look historically what the government takes in tax revenues, it averages about 18.1% of the real gross national product. That's all your tax revenues. That's personal income tax, corporate income tax, capital gains, estate taxes, gift taxes, payroll taxes. In other words, everything that the U.S. government collects in taxes on average is about 18% of the GDP. That's money that the government takes from people and transfer it. But by 2013, 16 years from now, that will only pay for entitlement programs. That's Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, the Obamacare subsidies, and some smaller programs such as CHIP. Don't want to get into the details other than I want to get across to you. You add the entitlements plus interest, and that's it. All your tax revenues only pay for that. I didn't mention national defense. I did not mention any of the other entitlement programs, and I did not mention any of the other welfare programs. You see the problem? Government spending is simply out of control. That's why both the Republicans and the Democratic Party have a spending addiction disorder. They will not face the tough decisions. And ladies and gentlemen, these are tough decisions. There's a deep denial on part of both parties to confront the fact that government spending is out of control. Now, you and I have very little control over that. But how does that impact you and me? Because of this, and why I consider this the number one problem, is we're getting lower economic growth rates and much higher, persistently high unemployment rates. The problem, ladies and gentlemen, is out-of-control spending. And you solve that problem by austerity, which means cutting this spending, drastically cutting. Cutting, for example, the wages and salary of government bureaucracies. Now, if you ask for my solution, I would permanently close 8 federal departments. That's just the start. There is no magic bullet here. There is not one thing to do that is going to solve this problem, because these numbers are immense, and we're going to have to pay the interest on that debt, because the debt is going to get bigger and bigger, because the one time the government fails to pay interest in the principal, that's what's technically called a default. And what happens after that? The government becomes high risk, and interest rates will skyrocket, double, triple, quadruple. Right now, the Federal Reserve, the central bank of the United States that's responsible for monetary policy, has been suppressing the interest rates, keeping them low, manipulating it to be very low to minimize the cost of the federal government's borrowings. That needs to cease. Because all the Fed is doing is monetizing this debt. And they'll go to the Congress and swear they're not doing, but they're doing it. They are doing it. But that is a dangerous, very dangerous game. And the Fed knows it, and that's why it's tapering, which is really only gradually cutting back on the number or on the amounts of Treasury securities that they're buying at auction through broker-dealers or through other commercial banks. Those are middlemen, but the point I'm trying to make is every business day, weekday, the Treasury has to be selling primarily notes and bonds to finance the federal government, because spending's out of control. Over a third has to be borrowed. They're really using that credit card. Now, they don't have a credit card. They issue this debt at relatively low interest rates or yields. But over time, what happens? And it's already happening. Investors in these Treasury securities reevaluate the risk of the federal government and want a higher risk premium to buy or invest in government securities. In simple terms, they want to be paid more interest. And what happens when you're borrowing so much money? Your interest, why now is only 6%, of the budget, will over time increase as a percentage. And that is going to squeeze out other department spending, as well as entitlement spending, as well as welfare spending. Because governments understand that the first thing you have to pay, the first thing you should pay, is the interest and principal. Because you're going to need to continue to borrow and borrow and borrow. And if you should be foolish enough or stupid enough to default, or technically default, by not paying interest or principal on the debts of the United States, what happens the next day? Your cost of borrowing goes through the roof. Dramatically, there's a quantum jump in the risk premium and how much money you're going to have to spend. And it's happened to other countries, including Greece. You might be paying 3, 4, 5%. And before you know it, you're paying 15, 20, 25%. I hope you take my point. And when you have to pay much higher interest rates, and you only have so much money coming in, what does that mean? You're going to have to cut spending. You see, that's why I say either you do it now in an orderly fashion, in a timely fashion, or you're going to be forced to do it, and it's not going to be pretty. Austerity truly has not begun. Don't be fooled for the rhetoric of President Obama. What he said, as far as I'm concerned, is very reckless, and I would even say dangerous, to give the impression that the first 5 years of his administration was an era of austerity is utter, complete nonsense. It's another one of his big whoppers, another big lie. It's beyond a lie. If you truly believe it, you are delusional. You don't run for the first 4 years massive deficits of $1.4 trillion in fiscal year 2009, $1.3 trillion in fiscal year 2010, just slightly under $1.3 trillion again in 2011, and in 12, a little over $1 trillion, slightly under 1.1. In his first 4 years of president, the deficits, if you add them all together, and it means increasing the debt, is over $5 trillion. That is not austerity. That is fiscal insanity. That is recklessness. That is a failed economic policy that results in what? Lower economic growth and a persistently high unemployment rate. In other words, the wrong economic policies have economic consequences, and we are seeing the economic consequences today. Millions of Americans are unemployed. Most would love to work, but can't find a job. And if you're a young person that hasn't had a job or has very, very few skill sets, you're in a world of hurts. Because you're competing with people that have the experience, have the maturity, have the skill sets that employers want. So you literally are confined to an area where you're competing with, guess who? Illegal aliens. And what does President Obama want to do? He wants to legalize, grant citizenship to the people that have been working here, granted over the last 10 years, but taking jobs away from American citizens, and they should come first. You see, I'm not against immigration. I'm actually for legal immigration. That's the only type of immigration that I'm favoring, as is most Americans. The only debate you'll have on the legal immigration front is the number of people we should allow every year to become American citizens. I wasn't consulted, and neither were the American people on this, because Congress, our representatives and senators over the years, has increased the amount of legal immigration to where today it's over 1 million people, and it's been that way for several years. That's entirely too high. It really should be brought back. The historical average for most of the United States history is about 250,000. We've had spikes up and down, but over most of our history, it was 250,000, sometimes much less, sometimes much more. What's unique about the last really roughly 25 years is the sheer amount of both illegal immigration. I call them illegal aliens. They broke into the country. They get false documents, and then they work here. You see, you have to have the legal status to work here. So if you don't and can get documents that can convince an employer that you do have it, not only are you committing a crime, but so is the employer. And who doesn't get the job? American citizens don't get the job. See, no one really knows the number of illegal aliens that are here. The number you hear in the news over and over and over and over again, it's 11 million, it's 11 million, it's 11 million. No, it's somewhere between 30 and 50 million. I don't know the number. I'm not in a position to know, but people who every day patrol the borders will tell you for every one they apprehend, a minimum of 3 to 5 get away. And the apprehensions until very, very recently were over 1 million a year. So every year, somewhere between 3 and 5 million illegal aliens were coming across the borders illegally, and that's just the Mexican-U.S. border, and that's half the problem, because the other half of the problem are people flying in here illegally on a visa and then overstaying their visa. That's why the real scope of the problem is somewhere between 30 and 50 million. That's why we have so many unemployed Americans. I've concluded that both political parties, mainly the Democratic Party, but also many in the Republican Party, really don't care about the American people or the American worker. Because if they did, the last thing they would do is propose, and they're doing it, either amnesty or a pathway to citizenship or giving legal status to the people that are already here. Because if you do that, what does that encourage? It just encourages more of the same. It's just like a subsidy. You subsidize something, you're going to get more of it. Another way to say it is if you cut prices, people will buy more. We need to stop cold illegal immigration. We also have to cut back on legal immigration. Because who is that hurting? It's hurting the American worker. It truly is hurting the American worker. The ruling elites don't care about the American worker, and it doesn't matter if they're Democrats or Republicans. All they care about is staying in power. And the Democrats, they look at the illegal aliens that are here and the more that would come in as future Democratic voters. And that's all they care about. And that means they think they can stay in power forever. But the core problem is out of control spending, because that is leading to lower growth rates, much higher unemployment. And when you add that with both the illegal immigration situation, it's a formula for disaster. It's a formula for massive civil unrest in the future. That is in the cards, because the American people are really waking up. And you can see it in the Gallup poll, where the number one problem is jobs or employment. And the number two problem is the economy. And the number three problem is government and corrupt politicians. And the number four problem is massive deficits and debt. I didn't see climate change on that list. Do you notice that? That's what the American people are concerned about. They perceive it as a problem. And yes, they're absolutely right. These are the major problems facing the country. And number five was health care, because the majority of American people want no part of Obamacare. Yet we have a president who, despite the wishes and demands of the American people, ignored them and pushed this through and is playing politics with it as I speak. It's a disaster. Just like his economic policies are a failure, Obamacare is a failure. We have a failed president. And what's making it worse is the story I went covered yesterday, that the Federal Communications Commission has commissioned a study where newsrooms, both in television stations and radio broadcasting stations, and even newspapers, will have a government monitor asking questions of the people in that newsroom. Let me cut to the chase here. The government has absolutely no role in this. Yes, they license radio and television stations, but it is not the job to determine what are the so-called critical information needs, nor what is the political philosophy of the people in the organization. It's none of their business. This is unconstitutional. This is un-American. This is a threat to the freedom of the press. And why some people have spoken out about it, I haven't heard much publicity. I've been listening. I would have thought by now that on every radio newscast across the country that there'd be stories on it. I haven't heard it. Now, I be fair, while I listen to a lot of radio, I don't listen to all of it, because most of the time I'm not listening to the radio. But I do listen to talk, and I haven't heard this. Now, where has it been? It has been on talk radio. This is by far a hot topic in talk radio. But my disappointment is, every major your ABC, your CBS, your NBC should be outraged. The reason why they're not outraged is they support Obama. But this is a direct threat to the liberty of the American people. It is a challenge to our own Constitution. This is unacceptable. This is a bad idea that should never have gotten out of the FCC. And as I said yesterday, I have my so-called theory of stupidity. Whenever you hear of an idea that is, you can't believe it, you got to be kidding me. Is this a joke? Usually it comes from the top. And by the top, I mean the President of the United States in this instance. Now, you have the same thing in the corporate world, the same thing in the military, or any bureaucracy. Because there are people, when the boss says, I have this great idea, all they do is salute. When they should be saying, if they're truly loyal and supportive of that individual, with all due respect, this is not a very good idea. Now, I'm not diplomatic. I will say, that's a stupid idea, and if you do it, it's going to really cause you a lot of political pain. And it should, and it will. Because this story is just getting started. What I'm waiting to see is the reaction, or lack of a reaction, of the major media. Now, Fox is on the case on this one, but I haven't seen much reaction out of the major television and news organizations, ABC, CBS, NBC, nor for that matter from the papers. They should be screaming. If George Bush had done this, they would be screaming, which is my point. They are so far in the tank for Barack Obama when he directly threatens freedom of the press. They stood by and said little or nothing. Little or nothing. They should be ashamed of themselves. Where is their professional integrity? Well, I'll tell you, they've lost that a long time ago. Don't think their professional ethics and integrity is going to suddenly come back. You see, we're fast approaching a tyranny. And it was interesting. Remember Obama, this was, several months ago, said, well, some people are going to call me a tyrant. I'm just one of many that are calling him a tyrant because he's not enforcing the law in the immigration area and the drug area. He's proposing, or his FCC is proposing. Don't think what the FCC does is not first checked, or how should I say this? I'm grasping for the right word. Run by the White House. Of course it was, and it should have been killed at that point. Usually when you have a major study like this or a government policy that would affect a broad spectrum of people, and this certainly qualifies there, this is run by the White House and other government agencies. This should never have gotten out of the FCC. Shame on them. Now, supposedly the FCC is starting to back down. I don't believe it for a minute. I won't say they back down until they say we're not going forward with this at all. Not modifying a few questions. That's not the, ladies and gentlemen, that's not what is the problem here. Is the fact that they thought that it was appropriate to have the government go into newsrooms, both of the press, of television, radio, and monitor what they're doing and ask questions about it. It's simply none of their business. They have no place there. And that is the point. And it's about time the so-called professional journalists that go to journalist school stand up and be counted. I'm not seeing many people standing up and being counted. Far from it. Shame on them. I am seeing people in so-called alternative media, both on the blogs, on podcasts, on talk radio, making this an issue, and they understand this is a direct threat to the personal liberty of the American people that relies on media to provide them information. Even though today there are more choices to get information than any time in my lifetime. We don't have a problem of too little information. We have a problem of too much information and an inability of the so-called journalism students to connect the dots. because many, especially in television, they're basically actors. They're reading a script. I'm not reading a script. I'm what's called on-air talent. It takes skills to do what I'm doing, and there are many people that have those skills. It's a very competitive marketplace, and you got to be relevant. You got to be interesting. You can't be boring. And believe me, when you cover economic issues where invariably you have numbers, it's not easy not to be boring. But you need to connect the two. You see, do you really think we have free in the Ukraine, where there, I haven't mentioned the Ukraine all week, but I'm going to mention it now. Do you think they have freedom in the press where a dictator's running it? No, they don't. Now, there is an outfit, and I forget the name, and I do apologize for it. But they do every year, what they do is they rank countries in terms of freedom of the press. Now, I knew the answer to this question, but the only reason I knew the answer to this question, I was researching, doing my show prep yesterday, and ran across this, and I have the chart, and I need to really update that, and I have some videos on this. But Glenn Beck had, when I was preparing today's show, I was kind of curious what Glenn Beck was saying, and he was posing to his staff of people that he has supporting him. He posed the question, and I'm going to pose it to my audience. In terms of, there are over 170 countries. I've lost track. Where do you think the United States ranking should be in terms of freedom of the press? Now, I would say before yesterday, I wouldn't know the exact number, but I would have guessed somewhere in the top 10. Somewhere in the top 10. Maybe 3 or 4. I don't know. But somewhere in the top 10. And I think most Americans would answer that question the same way. Many would say 1. I thought about it and said, no, not really. But this organization that puts out this, and I need to find the, it's a, they're press-related or news-related organization. It's a professional organization. And they routinely do this. What is the answer? What do you think it is? You will be shocked. Shocked. And if you go to the last show's notes, where you can get it, prongpops.wordpress.com. That's prongpops, prongpops.wordpress.com. You will find for the last show, which was 215, I believe is the number. I know it is the number. You will find that chart. I didn't give all the countries, but I did give the chart for the United States. And it has dropped. The United States rankings have dramatically dropped. Today in the world, we're 47. 47. We should be ashamed of that. Now, what was the reason for it? Because we have a president of the United States that has dramatically gone after so-called leakers. What in the press would they would say are sources of information. He has prosecuted more people in his administration than any other president in the entire history of the United States under the Espionage Act. That is the law he's trying to, what he's trying to do is stop leaking and intimidate people. Because in the news, I'm in the opinion commentary business, but in the news business, you're only as good as your sources, and you have to cultivate your sources, and you got to have their confidence and trust. So this president has deliberately gone after not only the leakers, but the press. That's why the rankings dropped. We were not in the top 10 even before this. And after this FCC thing, we have a president that really does not like to be criticized. He is thin-skinned. That is his problem. He's a narcissist. He suffers from narcissistic personality disorder, which is a separate show. But I think that diagnosis is accurate. He can't stand to be criticized or corrected. It sticks in his craw when Fox tells the truth about his lies, when Hannity tells the truth about his lies and background. He doesn't want it. He wants to stop it. He doesn't believe in the freedom of the press, because if he did, he never would have. The White House and him would have stopped this FCC study. They didn't. They let it go. Now, because of the pushback, they supposedly are backing off. I'll wait to see if that happens. I really don't think they're going to. I think he thinks he can get away with it. And he will until people start standing up and speaking out. And that includes our Congress. That includes our representatives and senators. And that includes the so-called leaders of the media. I am waiting to hear from the presidents of these media organizations. I probably won't be hearing from them. Now, I know what they fear. Every 8 years, their licenses come up for renewal. And see, that's what we're seeing. This is an attempt to intimidate the critics of President Obama, and it's working, especially for the so-called establishment media. Where it's not working is the alternative media that more and more people are turning to. You see, that's the problem that Obama is facing. But he's going after the internet as well. We have all the signs, ladies and gentlemen, of a tyrant. Of a tyrant. And remember, he brought up that word. People will be calling me a tyrant. Yes, they will, because when you act like a tyrant, you're accused of being a tyrant. And when you, under the Constitution, are responsible for enforcing the law, you're not responsible for making the law. That is the job of Congress, not you, Mr. President. And you, as a constitutional lawyer, should understand that. But as a Marxist-Leninist, you don't believe in the rule of law. You have all the makings of a totalitarian, and you're showing your true colors. The mask is falling off because you don't have to run again. Now, I'm waiting for the leaders in Congress, the leaders in the media, the leaders in other professions, the academics to stand up to this. I might be waiting a long time because with few but some very notable exceptions, the leadership of the Republican Party is not really standing up to this. And that's why I'm not a Democrat or a Republican. I believe in limited government, and if we had limited government, we wouldn't have these massive deficits that have directly resulted in not only larger debt, but much lower growth rates, as well as persistently high unemployment rates. They all go together. They all connect. You see, one of the problems that the American people rightly say, we have corrupt politicians, both in the White House and in the Congress, in the House and the Senate. That's not new. We've always had corruption to various degrees, as do other countries. Because if we had people of integrity that are willing to stand up and be counted, this should have been stopped. It takes courage. I understand that. It courage or fortitude to stop. But first, you have to understand what's going on. You have to connect the dots. And that's why we rely on the freedom of the press, both the establishment, big media, so-called mainstream media, as well as other sources, to provide us with the information we need to make informed judgments of what's going on. And to the extent that they do their job, we're aware of it. And to the extent that they fall down not doing their job, the American Republic faced his danger. Because if they had been doing their job in 2008, President Obama would never have been nominated, nor would he have been elected president. That is a fact. It's a fact that they don't want to address, because they bear a lot of responsibility for their failures or lapses in poor judgment without, in terms of truly vetting the president. Because if they had, ladies and gentlemen, either John McCain or Hillary Clinton would be president today. They look the other way. The expression you'll hear is they were in the tank for Obama. They wanted him to be elected. It made him feel good. We're going to elect the first black president. I don't care what color he is. But I do care about his background and his past, because that explains a lot, if not most, of what's happening today. And is the president's cavalier attitude to the law. For someone that went to law school and specialized in constitutional law, and he does what he does, I shake my head. If I went to Harvard, Laura, I'd be ashamed to have him as an example. I know many of them think he's terrific. And where did it get us? What did it get us? A little dictator? A little tyrant? He's going to be stopped. He is going to be stopped one way or the other. Because the American people are wide awake. Took a while, but you see it in the Gallup poll. You see it in the Gallup poll in terms of the top 10 problem. Jobs, unemployment, the economy, government, corrupt politicians, massive deficits, massive debt, health care. And those are only the top five. There are others. But those are the top five. And remember what the top five are. People are now going to be voting their pocketbook. They should have been voting their pocketbook in 2012. But now many of the so-called supporters of Obama have massively become disillusioned with him because he hasn't delivered the goods. Many of the, especially the young, think, oh, we're going to have good jobs. Hasn't worked out too well, has it? We're going to have free health care. It's not free, is it? Oh, you get subsidies, but most of you, if you don't have a job, at best you're going to get Medicaid. You see, it's vitally important to be an informed citizen, and that takes a vibrant and vigorous press, whether it be newspapers, magazines, the so-called print media, whether it's radio stations, both news and talk radio, as well as television, the major networks, as well as cable. And now, thank God for the internet. Because without a strong press doing its job, tyrants get in control. Dictators get in control. And when they go for the two things that any dictator or tyrant goes for. One, he confiscates the guns. And number two, he takes over the television stations, the radio stations, and the newspapers. Wake up, America. We have a president that wants to do exactly that. And what amazes me is we've had scandal after scandal after scandal, and we still have President Obama in the White House, as well as Attorney General Holder. Fast and furious, amazing, unbelievable. Listen to the last show. The same thing with Benghazi. The IRS scandal. Going after the press. What the National Security Agency is doing, massively gathering wholesale all our communications. And do I need to mention the drone program? Killing innocent Americans as well as innocent people abroad? Those are just some of the scandals. But the bigger scandal is the failed economic policies that are causing pain and suffering of the people that simply cannot find jobs. And our young people looking for their first job, and especially after going after completing their college degrees, can't find a job commensurate with those skills. And literally, if they're lucky, settle for a job you don't even need a high school diploma for. With that, I'm going to wrap up my show. I thank you for listening. It's not quite 2 hours, but it's close. You are listening to KDUX Web Radio, broadcasting live from Richland College in Dallas, Texas. We're the voice of Richland College. My name is Raymond Thomas Pronk, the presenter of the Pronk Pop Show. Views expressed on this show are my own, unless otherwise stated, and do not reflect the opinion of anyone at KDUX, Richland College, or the DCCD. Thank you for listening. Do your homework assignments, and now back to the music.